Today on the Crisscross Cinema Podcast, Godzilla rises from the depths once again to terrorize Tokyo. But is this a surprisingly human story? Our review of Godzilla Minus One on the Crisscross Cinema Podcast.
Two fellows meet accidentally, like you and me. No connection between them at all, never saw each other before. They swap murders. Crisscross.
Wilson! I'm sorry, Wilson!
A day may come when the courage of men fails. But it is not this day.
You gotta keep breathing. Because tomorrow the sun will rise. Who knows what the tide could bring.
Hello and welcome to the Crisscross Cinema Podcast, where we weave in and out of cinema history and find connections you may have never recognized. Today we're going to be reviewing Godzilla Minus One. If you like what you hear on today's show, please support us on Patreon at patreon.com/transcendentertainment. That's TRANSCEND entertainment. Hello, I'm Aaron Wilson. I'm a filmmaker refining my craft.
And I am Mark Klobus, huge fan of Godzilla. I'm such a big fan that I know this is going to cost me a lot of credibility with you. When I first saw the 1998 Roland Emmerich Godzilla, I thought it was a good movie.
No, I did too. I saw it when I was a kid, and I loved that thing.
Well, I'm glad I'm not gonna be going down on that one alone. So it's
yeah,
but fortunately, I feel like I can say that about Godzilla Minus One, and not feel as and not confident that it's not going to be a judgment that it will be subsequently invalidated by, you know, perspective and wisdom.
No, yeah, it's no spoilers, but it's a really good movie.
Cannot recommend it highly enough. It's definitely that category of films that really must be seen in the theaters for full appreciation.
Right. Okay. I guess we should cover a little bit of our background of what we are, our backgrounds with Godzilla.
Yes.
I'll go first because mine is shorter. So I think the first Godzilla movie I saw, well, I mean, I just through the grapevine, I'd seen Godzilla versus Kong on a TV at a friend's house. Didn't watch the whole movie, just a piece of it. The real first movie that I watched was Godzilla 1988, and I loved it. It was it was fun. Yeah, looking back on it, I still have a side of me that's like, yeah, I like this, but I do see the flaws. So, then going into Japanese Godzilla, I think the first one I saw was probably Godzilla versus Mothra, and that was pretty recently. It was probably about 10 years ago max. And then, of course, there's the 2014 Godzilla, which I loved. Story is not great. The character, human characters are horrible, non-existent. Maybe I should save that till we review that. But yeah, that
might be a good one for future crisscrosses to compare that 2014 one with some other Godzilla movie or
right.
Maybe a Kong movie. So
yeah, I was even thinking comparing it to Gareth Edwards' Monsters, which is probably what landed him the Godzilla role.
Undoubtedly.
Yeah. So,
yeah. Well, you're absolutely correct, Aaron, that mine is a much further history. It goes all the way back to
10 years later.
It goes all the way back to the 1970s. There was a TV station that would show on Saturday mornings. This is back before the age of VHS. You had to watch everything on TV. And they had these movie blocks. So they would have, like, you know, they would do, like, you know, romance movies during a given window. So if you wanted to watch a romance movie, you tune in at this time. Saturday mornings at 10:30, one of the local TV stations had this show called World Beyond. And this kind of cheesy VFX opening. And then they basically use it as they would show a variety of science fiction, supernatural, horror, whatever they happened to have hired. And without a doubt, my weekend was made if I turned it on and there was a Godzilla movie. And they were all the old ones from the Showa era. They were all like from the original Godzilla King of Monsters from 1956, all the way up through Terror of Mechagodzilla from 1975. And so I was able to watch a lot of them, and I can recognize now with the, you know, the hindsight, they're all varying quality. But I, before all the other franchises, all the other films that I was a fan of, I was a Godzilla fanatic. And my as a kid, what I wanted to do is I wanted to make Godzilla movies when I was growing up because I loved them so much. And then there was this gap where, you know, Worlds Beyond went off the air. I didn't watch Godzilla as much. And then, thanks to having a cable and on AMC in the 90s, they would show all the more recent Godzilla movies that Japan did.
Oh.
And they're different in a lot of ways. They're a bit of a reboot, starting back with 1985, which is the hardest Godzilla film to get on DVD nowadays. But they're also very fascinating. I watched them with a more mature eye, and I still had the Godzilla affection, and the affection, I think, is why when they finally did the American Godzilla movie they'd been talking about for decades, and it came on, I was like, wow, this is great. I remember I saw it in a theater in Chicago with a friend, and we walked out, and I was like, that was a great movie. And my friend said, did we see the same movie? But like you, I mean, I still have a certain nostalgic connection, and I love the 2014 movie, and I'm not as fond of the sequels, but I love Shin Godzilla, and that's another one we could perhaps talk about at some point. But Godzilla Minus One, oh my gosh, chef's kiss! It is absolutely,
yeah, it's a great movie.
Oh my gosh, it's so good, and I find it fascinating because, like Shin Godzilla, it starts with the premise that, you know, there is no such thing as Godzilla before. It's like you get into the later Showa movies, and it's like this whole thing. It's like literally civilization's been built up around Godzilla. I mean, the world's figured out how to contain Godzilla, or the world deals with Godzilla the same way you deal with a natural disaster, what have you. But no, we're going to go back to, you know, we're going to go back to square one. We're going to go back to the foundation. We're going to say Godzilla is this unknown threat, but we're going to take it, and I just thought it was so fascinating.
Yeah, and so I feel like it was almost a remake of the first one, mm-hmm. just from a different point of view.
Mm-hmm. So. And it's one that is informed, I think, by a lot of the skepticism that people today have about government, which is very different than the 1950s. And that's mm-hmm. one of the, and I imagine somewhere we could actually do a crisscross episode where we compare the two in that respect. But it was interesting to see how this notion of sort of the Japanese on their own, and
right.
I mean you get to some of the Godzilla movies, and it's really about how Japan becomes this great nation, and Godzilla becomes a symbol of that greatness. And this does go back to the idea of Godzilla as, you know, Japan as a victim, which could be a little controversial. But it's like, how can you, you know, it's inspiring.
Right.
This idea that you know, these people who pull themselves together.
Yeah, there's that speech that he gives near the end that really ties into the main character's arc or through line that we'll get to later. But just saying that the Japanese government was like sending out kamikazes and didn't have a value for human life. Mm-hmm. We value human life. Mm-hmm. And it's really touching the way. And it ties in with the main character's mm-hmm. arc.
Well, let's get into the movie itself because
yeah.
I'm so looking forward to delving into it.
Yeah.
And this goes back to my experience with it. If you watch one of the 1990s movies, one of my favorite ones, and it's not because it's a great movie or even a great Godzilla movie, is Godzilla versus King Ghidorah.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting because they do this homage, you know, hat tip to Spielberg in it. And what they do in it is, the premise of it, and it's such a fun movie, is that, you know, Godzilla's the threat. These people come from the future, and they're like, well, Godzilla's going to become this global threat in the future, in our time, so we want to basically, you know, negate Godzilla's existence.
Right.
And what they do is they've traced Godzilla back to this dinosaur, a Godzillasaurus, that is on an island in the Pacific in 1944, And the plan is to go back in time and somehow and transport Godzilla away, because that island will subsequently be the location of an atomic bomb test. So they go back in time. They see how the Japanese soldiers who've kind of adopted Godzilla, not in an affectionate way, but support him and they revere him. And he helps them defeat the Americans, and then they get escorted off, and then the aliens transport Godzilla away, and then the plot goes on from there. But I felt that the way that the film opens, Godzilla Minus One, mm-hmm. is in some ways a callback to that idea that we're going to go ahead and root this in this period of Japan's desperation. Only right. they really I think go back to the core idea that Godzilla is not their friend.
Yeah, and there really is that feeling throughout the movie. They're just, and this is where the title comes from. I looked it up.
Oh,
they're at zero at this point.
Yes,
their civilization, and Godzilla comes in and brings them less than zero.
Yes.
So they're minus one.
That's interesting. I did not know that. So.
Well, the thing that I think this movie has that differentiates it from the majority of Godzilla in Godzilla history mm-hmm. Is it's a very personal story, like mm-hmm. on the human level. This one character, you're following him through this whole thing, and it's his story. Almost to the point where you could remove Godzilla from this movie and it would still work as a movie.
That's something that I think really distinguishes good. It's something I don't think a lot of filmmakers appreciate when they do films like this, which is the fact that these massive kaiju stories really work best when they're about the people.
Right.
You watch the original Gojira, and that's exactly what it's about. It's a Gojira. This is something I read recently that made an excellent point about the difference between the way Americans do Godzilla films, the way the Japanese do. Godzilla, in so many of them, is a force of nature.
That's what I was going to say.
Yeah, and so it's about the people coping with it, and they appreciate that. I think the filmmakers of Godzilla Minus One really get that.
Yeah, and they've tried to do it, and I think the one that's come closest in the American ones is not the original Godzilla King of Monsters, but the most recent Godzilla King of Monsters, where they've got the family that was affected by the catastrophes that happened in the first Godzilla mm-hmm. 2014, and it's really the story of this family. But where it loses me, though, is the mom just turns into evil, weird thing, and they try to redeem her at the end. It's like, you're not redeemable, lady.
Yeah, I have my issues with that. I need to go back and rewatch it. I haven't seen it since it was in theater. But I would actually suggest, if you want an even better example, watch the Apple TV Monarch Legacy of Monsters.
Oh, I've been meaning to watch that. I don't have Apple TV, but yeah.
I'm about partway through the episodes that are out now, and I think they really do capture the humanness of it. The kaiju are there, and they're
cool.
Very well integrated. But it ultimately is
about, well, I kind of have to on a TV show budget.
you wouldn't know it's a TV show budget.
Oh, really?
Well, it's Apple TV show budget. I mean,
oh right,
they can throw millions into foundation, and
they've got Pixar money.
Exactly.
So, okay, there's a gripe that I have to cover that I just remembered. Okay. The VFX for Godzilla at the beginning and that island scene mm-hmm. where the planes are being attacked were just janky. Like,
I don't know. I think you have a better eye for that than I do. I didn't really notice the jankiness quite so much.
Yeah.
So
anyway, back to the story. But that scene, though, that was just the way that he couldn't shoot and he's just frozen and he blames himself for, and the other survivor guy blames him for the engineer.
I think this is where I found him to be very relatable. And this is one of the things I really liked about his portrayal, which is that it can be so difficult to in so many films to take a character like that and say, you know, who's he's being sent on a mission like that. And to make him into kind of a one-dimensional figure.
Right.
But watching the beginning, I mean, you see him, he has effectively shirked his duty.
Yeah.
And, you know...
And I didn't pick that up until he mentions it later that, oh, he's a kamikaze. Why is he coming back from a mission?
I thought you first get it when he lands and the engineer goes up to him and says...
Oh, right, yeah. I picked up on that.
There's nothing wrong with your plane. And he's like... you're just even like looking around.
Yeah.
And they, of course, I mean, the assumption is that he's going to fly out the next day. And
right. Yeah, but that personal story of him, he comes home, and this is really where it really hits of his next door neighbor, like, blames him for, yes. He's like, you're a coward, and he feels like a coward. And he's got this survivor's guilt. It's just the big thing.
And I'm watching that. I'm thinking to myself, okay, yeah. Your plane would have single-handedly have, you know, had you fall through your mission, you would have stopped the war. And you don't, you know, it's, I say this sarcastically because, yeah, he just would have been another casualty.
Yeah.
And you get a sense as to the utter worthlessness of that sacrifice with what happens at the end. Mm-hmm. The sense that, you know, had he thrown his life away, even if he had completed his mission successfully, that at the end it wouldn't have changed anything, and you sacrifice that the promise of those of the way those people you know what those people could have done. Like, it's like that line from Unforgiven, you that he would have given up everything he was and everything he could have been, and mm-hmm. so many Japanese had done that, and he makes what I think an audience would regard as the sensible choice. And yet he feels awful about it because
yeah he's completely self blaming about it or self condemning about it. Mm-hmm. He meets this other lady that has this baby and it's not her baby, and he's like, why are you taking care of a kid that's not yours? And ironically, he starts taking care of her.
Yes.
And I don't know, it's just so touching or poignant, that relationship. Like, that's what I'm talking about. Like, this could just be an independent Japanese film, and I'd watch it.
Oh, exactly. I mean, it's you forget that it's a Godzilla film.
Yeah.
You've already been introduced to Godzilla.
And he's not around for big chunks of this movie.
Yes. I mean, they occasionally will insert him. He never entirely goes away. But what you get is this idea of how these people are recovering from this trauma. That scene where he goes back to his parents' house, and it's just rubble.
Right.
And his neighbor, who's angry at him, her house is rubble. And it's just this idea that they had to really start from the ashes, literally.
Yeah.
To rebuild. And you see him doing that, and it gives you a sense as to what he does. The job he takes, I think also underscores the fact that it's not that he's not brave, because what he does is not, you know, the kind of thing that a scared person, a person who is afraid of the
yeah,
world.
Yeah, even she's like, why are you doing such a dangerous job? And I can't remember what he says. But
he does it for her. He does it because the money's good.
Yeah. He's like, just because it's dangerous doesn't mean I'm going to die or something like that.
And then you get the crew of the fishing boat.
Right.
I love how initially he's kind of like, you know, we're going to do it in this boat. And it's like, well, actually, all these things you think make the boat terrible actually allows us to do this job, which is we're going to go out and blow up mines.
Yeah. And the boat's made of wood, so it doesn't set off the mines with the metal.
And then you get this wonderful cross section. You get the crusty
old guy,
the smart guy, the young guy,
the new rookie.
Yeah, the rookie, yeah. Exactly. The one who sits there is like, oh, it would have been great. I just missed out. And all three of them are like, no, you didn't miss anything.
Yeah.
So, but the film takes the time to get to know them, for you to for them to get to know each other.
Yeah.
You see them bonding. You see them developing.
The scene where they come and have dinner at his house.
Yes.
And they're like, why aren't you marrying her?
Yes.
And it's, I think, oh, that's the biggest thing that I love about this movie. He doesn't want to live. Like, he doesn't think he deserves it. And so he's not getting married to her, not because he thinks it's the right thing or he's scared. I guess he's scared a little bit, but the main thing is that he doesn't think he deserves it.
Mm-hmm. And that's where I think it goes back to the introduction of the woman he's living with and the baby, which is that he doesn't feel he deserves to live, but he feels he has to live for them. It's
right.
That's his mission. And that, it kind of annoyed me when it was happening, but then I reflected upon it and I thought, you know, that actually is great from a storytelling sense, because it makes sense as to why he doesn't just, you know, decide to end it all, or why he doesn't just check out altogether.
Yeah.
He has a purpose and he lives for that purpose.
They're his tether. And then Should I give away the middle part?
Go ahead.
Yeah. So the big, gigantic Godzilla attack. And this is a direct reference to the big, famous scene of Godzilla taking Tokyo from the original movie. He picks up the train, and she's in it, his girlfriend, and she ends up falling down into the water. But as she's running away on the street from Godzilla, like classic Godzilla, all the Japanese people running away. The main character comes in and runs and helps her, mm-hmm. and they hide in this little tiny alleyway.
Yeah, they do it as Godzilla's stomping past. I actually want to go back a little bit because it's key to how they set it up, which is that Japan 1945 is under an American occupation, and they will be till 1952. The United States literally runs it, and they have to work around that, especially when it's also this idea that, you know, they're cognizant of this question. Where are the B-29s? Where are the battleships? Why doesn't the United States just come in and just, you know, bam, 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 and teach and deal with Godzilla, which is a problem that they've created. They've nuked the island, and Godzilla's irradiated. He's already destroyed an American submarine, yet the United States is kind of like, whatever. So they have this kind of hand-wave way, well, we don't want to, you know, have tensions with the Soviets and everything. So it's up to the Japanese to kind of pull themselves up by their bootstraps and do this themselves.
Right.
The most the United States is going to do...
Without the government.
Yeah, without the government. The most the United States is going to do for them is they're going to let them have the last major warship that has not been destroyed by the United States. And this was actually true. This was the Takao was a heavy cruiser. It was in Singapore at the end of the war, and it was like the last major warship that the United States never sunk. And so the United States is graciously allowing the Japanese to demand it. They're sort of returning a bit of their manhood, so to speak. But the Japanese have to rely upon themselves, and so they have to be clever. They have to be smart. And that's where you get the whole, we're going to do this with mines. Not really aware of the scope threat. You get you get that great...
I didn't get that the Japanese were the ones that set the mines.
Well, the mines are both American and Japanese.
Oh, okay.
The Japanese put up mines against the invasion. The Americans, you know, literally seeded the waters with mines at the end of the war. And their whole mission was to clean those up. Right. So, but they decided instead of destroying them, they're going to use them against Godzilla. And you get that great scene, which is possibly my favorite scene in the movie, with the two fishing boats, and you have and initially they're kind of like, you know, bravado, oh yeah, we're gonna get this Godzilla, and they're kind of, you know, doing it, and then Godzilla shows up and they see Godzilla for the first time in his mutated form, and Godzilla just instantly destroys one of the boats.
Yeah.
And the other guy is like the bravado. And it's like, I think just about everyone must have been thinking about it. And every American is thinking, probably that scene in Jaws, Roy Scheider, we're going to need a bigger boat.
Yeah.
Nobody says it, thankfully, because that would have been a little too on the nose. And so it's like, so they're like running away as fast as they can, and Godzilla's chasing them. It's like that meme of, you know, the profile of Godzilla from one of the Showa movies, and it's like they're the face that your Hot Pocket sees in the microwave oven. It's kind of like he's coming for you, and they're blazing away, and they're shooting at it. Nothing's working. Then the cruiser shows up, and it's like we're going to see, you know, they're giving it their best effort, and Godzilla just like, whatever.
Yeah.
That's
an amazing scene.
Yeah, it climbs. I just have climbs.
Effects wise, that scene is way better than the opening. That's
that
interaction with the water and just how massive he is. Yeah. I don't know how they did that.
It looks so seamless.
Yeah,
I sometimes think the problem is not that we use too much CGI; it's that we rush the process.
Yeah, that's definitely the case.
And I get the impression they took their time with this because they wanted to do it right. And my gosh, does it show in that scene?
Yeah. So speaking of memes, I saw one on Godzilla recently. You know, the Don't Tread on Me flag?
I know the flag.
Yeah. It was Godzilla over a city on that yellow backdrop. And it's like, I'll tread wherever I want.
It certainly makes that point clear in the movie.
Yeah, most definitely. While we're jumping back, I want to jump back to, like, when he gets to the city and it's all rubble. Is that, like... fallout from a nuclear bomb, or is that just normal bombing?
Are you talking after Godzilla, or
when he first gets home from the war, and he's everything's in rubble.
Oh, that's from the United States. The United States, we
focused. But was it the nuke or?
Oh no, it was conventional bombing. Japanese cities were made largely of wood, and they had to part with the available building materials, and in part because Japan uses wood because it is more flexible in dealing with tremors.
Earthquakes.
A lot of earthquakes. And the United States used that during the war by firebombing the cities, where they sent in B-29s with incendiaries, and they created these enormous firestorms. The one that hit Tokyo killed more civilians than either of the atomic bombings.
Oh, wow.
The effect of the atomic bombings was that it was one bomb by one plane that took out an entire city.
Yeah.
But they achieved that degree of destruction that you see in the movie, or that they portray in the movie, using squadrons of B-29s, firebombing Japan, devastating it. And that was the experience of the war for a lot of the civilians who survived it, was the United States literally roaming at will over it. The Japanese did their best by that point. They pretty much exhausted their military power trying to stop the United States from getting to Japan. And so those cities were devastated, and it took them years to rebuild. It's part of the undercurrent of the original Godzilla, the original Gojira, which is that Japan has rebuilt.
Right.
And yet here's Godzilla knocking it down again. And they kind of pace that out more, where you see, and I love how they do it. They do it with his home. He comes, it's rubble. He gradually puts the money into it. He rebuilds it. So by the time you get near the later part of the movie, he's got this nice, cozy little structure, wood. It's
nice.
I was kind of, gosh, I'd like to live there.
Yeah.
Full mini home. But that was all before Godzilla. And it was something that was IRL. And then you get to that scene you were just referencing, where Godzilla's attacking a partially rebuilt Tokyo, and he's taking out buildings that, survived the bombings. He's taking out buildings they put up since then. He does that great scene, like you said, the callback with the elevated rail and chewing.
Oh yeah, yeah, mm-hmm, the train.
Yeah, and then you have that. This gets to my one major issue with the movie, which is how they had to, and you know the terminology better than I do, fridging.
I was about to get there.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, so his girlfriend that he's living with, she gets killed, and I love the way they do it here because. It's again survivor's guilt.
Yes.
Just lay it on him again, and it has a massive effect on him through the rest of the movie. And then, of course, if you've seen it, which don't listen any further if you haven't seen it, she ends up being alive at the end. And I love the way they did that. It wasn't just a, I don't know. They could have done that really clunkily, but they did it really well.
Well, I kind of felt it was the fact that. It was underscoring the sacrifice that I unnecessarily. It was also the idea that why doesn't she just dive in with him? Why does she have to push him away? Why can't she just basically throw herself at him and do it in there? It was like that she had to throw herself away for the plot. It just bugs the heck out of me.
Yeah, I get that.
So, but then of course we see how the best efforts of what of the remnants of the Japanese military can do. Their cruiser is sunk. Their tanks, such as they are blown apart. And this is just an aside as a Godzilla fan. It's fascinating. They're always changing the radioactive breath.
Yeah, I loved the way they did that in this movie of it. Mm-hmm. It literally makes an atomic explosion, and it's like it invokes that. Like I don't know if in this universe. Hiroshima and Nagasaki didn't happen, or
oh no, they did.
Oh, did they? Yeah. Anyway, but it brings in that imagery, and you feel that even more.
Only now it's Tokyo; it's like Japan's being hit again, and I think it's an effective way of underscoring the sense of shock.
Yeah.
Afterward, they're just
and it works.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh, does it?
Yeah.
And it's like they've tried their best with the tools at hand, and they have failed. What can they do now? And it's not like they can surrender to Godzilla. I mean, that worked for the Americans. It's not going to work with this thing.
Right. Okay. Back to the main character's arc. I loved it. but I almost hated it. I saw it coming of what I thought they were going to do, and we're in spoilers, so we can say it. The self-sacrifice thing of, like, he's going to go in and kamikaze for real into Godzilla's mouth with all these explosives and blow up. And at the end, he does that, and you're like, why did you do that? Like, this is so against them, what the message should be. And then they show the parachute coming down. Yes. It's like, oh, yay.
And they show how it was that, and the way that they explain why he made that choice at the end to save himself rather than doing it, I felt was so earned because of how they reintroduced the engineer.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I want to take it back to how after Godzilla, wipes out Tokyo, and they decide that, okay, the government's has failed, so we're gonna have to science this. And so they come up and this is of course where we find out that the guy in the boat was actually a genius weapon designer, and he's got this clever plan all figured out where they're going to use, nature to defeat Godzilla. They're gonna sink Godzilla.
I thought that was really clever.
Oh, it was very clever, and it's the kind of thing which it kind of harkens to the fact that he is there's plenty out there about why Godzilla is physically impossible.
Yeah,
and people will talk about how how much urine a creature that size will generate and how it'll probably drown the world or something like that. But you have to accept that, that the 400-foot-tall lizard has to exist.
And also, you get to a certain size with being an animal and you start crumpling under your own weight.
Yeah.
But you got to have it.
Exactly. I mean, you have to have that suspension of disbelief for the kaiju to work. And I feel like they've built that into the creature design. You look at the Godzilla of like the 50s through the 70s, really through the 90s. It's this, basically a large dinosaur. And you're starting to see the notion of mass. I mean, how the legs have to be these enormous things to support.
Yeah.
They're sort of saying, look, let's make this plausible-ish.
My brother, when we were watching it, he's like, you didn't skip leg day.
Well, he kind of had to.
Yeah.
He couldn't afford to, otherwise he wasn't going to do it. But it also kind of implies that it gets to why I think he has to be more of an aquatic creature. Mm-hmm. And you think about how much of Godzilla you see in the movie is, after the mutation, is he is in water versus on land.
Right.
And that I kind of see is in the same way that the largest creatures on Earth are aquatic, that you can see how he can be on land, but only for short periods of time. I kind of like that in a way.
Yeah.
So, but they're going to science it. They're going to science it by finding the deepest point they can, sinking him, and that will, hopefully kill him with pressure. And if not, they'll kill him by massive expansion. And that scene where they're explaining the plan and all these people are like, why do we have to be the ones to do this? We stepped up, we served our country, and they threw the what you were referencing earlier.
Right.
We stepped up. We saw all of our friends' lives thrown away. We barely survived, and I'm sure they're feeling that that it's not like they have anything to prove here.
Yeah.
And so, you're asking us to do it again. So those guys walk out, and part of me as a viewer is like, okay, great. So you're just going to basically die at home, and then part of me is like, well, I can't blame them. I mean, what more are they supposed to do at this point? And what sense do they really have that, okay, all these other plans, the idea of we're going to have you dive your plane into the ship, that's going to save Japan. Okay, that didn't work out. But this one here will.
Right.
Especially when, the risks they're running, and you see that risk later on. It's that wonderful scene where they're getting ready at the pier, and they have the early warning that Godzilla's approaching. And then that ship goes arcing through the air. Okay, that was
flying onto shore. Yeah,
you have to wonder if some of the guys aboard that boat, as they were dying, were thinking, yet again, another fine mess that we've gotten into because it was never going to work, and they probably in the tragedy of them dying, not realizing the plan was going to succeed. Oh, spoiler.
but that plan though. Him kamikazing, if that would have gone through, that would have been so bad. Just the the self-sacrifice after so much survivor's guilt would mean no change for him. Yeah. He's just a flat.
Yeah, and he had that was like, it wasn't like he had survivor's guilt because his girlfriend died. That was on top of his
started back
triple
from
deck
the beginning.
Sandwich of survivor's guilt.
Exactly.
Didn't kamikaze, didn't stand up to the Godzilla on the island, and now this, or it didn't succeed in stopping Godzilla when he on the boat, and then this, and it's like, oh my gosh, he practically, he has guilt morning, noon, and night.
Yeah. It had me angry at the end, where I'm like, you seriously gonna do this? Even after like the speech you were saying where they're like, Japanese government didn't value life, we value life. Mm-hmm. And it's like, good, that's perfect. That's what his message needs to be. Mm-hmm. And then they do that flashback, which is so great. I would think it was clunky, but the way they do it.
They find this plane, which was an actual real plane, but
right.
They were able to deploy in time during the war. And how the guy says, the protagonist says, well, we need to fly, but we need to find this engineer for it. And it's the other survivor from the island.
Yeah.
And he
Which
comes
is great in, thematically wise.
And he's still bitter, and they have to track him down from wherever he is. And this is, the old fashioned way, but he shows up and he's.
Well, real quick, like the way that he does it is he sends a letter to him and he comes back and he like is beating on him and he's like, why did you send that letter to me? And he's like, right. I thought I knew it would make you angry and I knew it would make you come.
Yes. He knows exactly what button to push to
get
there. He just needs to find out where to send it to.
So. Yeah.
And so then then he explains what the plan is going to be. So they know, the idea of kamikazing, that's not the plan. The plan is,
right.
He's designed to be a lure. He's going to be the bait to chase, especially when Godzilla goes inland and they need him in that particular spot to sink him. So we're just going to go ahead and build the plane, which is fast enough to where Godzilla can't possibly shoot it down. And we're just going to irritate him with 20 millimeter cannon shells and then hopefully get him to where we can sink him.
Yeah.
And the idea that he has the bomb in there and that he's going to, commit suicide. That's
his thing.
Yeah. That's his plan C. And everyone thinks there's just two plans.
So with the flashback, it flashes back to when they're going over like the armaments and how he's telling him how to use the plane and like pull this lever to arm the bombs. And he's like, this airplane has an ejection seat. And
which wasn't as common back then as you might think.
Yeah. They make a point of it, of the Japanese planes don't have ejection seats.
But this one does.
Because they value the price more than life.
And it really has to be the engineer that does it. It's like, why that engineer? It's not like this guy is the only.
Yeah, he's mechanic. The guy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's not the only mechanic in Japan, but he wants him because, in a sense, it's as though he's saying that if I can, that this guy will understand what I'm doing, he'll be like, hey, can I arm the bomb for you before you get in there?
Oh, I see. Yeah. I didn't consider that part.
Yeah. He's saying that the engineer, at the very least, is going to enable what he does. He probably will do it eagerly. And so what you see, and I think it's not just the ejection sheet, it's the fact that it's the engineer. He is the only person who could convince the protagonist to eject.
Yeah, and then the engineer tells him, choose life. And
exactly.
That's what sold that flashback for me. I'm like, oh, okay, I get what they're doing.
He doesn't say it, but he is effectively saying,
and that's
I forgive you.
Yeah, and also there's a certain point in the movie where he decides to live again.
Mm-hmm.
But then she dies, and he thinks, oh, I should not have done that. And he goes back to what he was. And at this point, the engineer gives him permission. You need to live.
Yes. He's appreciated it. You see that early in the movie. He appreciates the value of living on. He just can't accept it.
Right.
And so he doesn't do what everyone's telling him to do, which is to propose.
Yeah.
And then
she dies.
And then she dies.
Like, that can't propose anymore.
Yeah, exactly. He blew that opportunity. And the engineer is basically saying to him, that you can choose to live. And, I'm giving you permission.
Yeah.
Permission. So, and he takes it. And maybe he takes it because of the girl. Who sometimes it's like she's, I don't feel they use the baby enough.
The scenes she's in like are really good acting for such a young child. But
I don't think the story utilizes her as well enough. She's convenient when she needs to be, it's always convenient to have that neighbor to hand her off to.
Yeah.
So it's not like I have to stay here to take care of you.
Well, the end when he hands her off to her, it's great storytelling because it's like, oh, you see the look in the neighbor's eyes of you know what he's going to do, mm-hmm. and she's not down with that.
She's forgiven him at this
point. She was calling him a coward and stuff, and now she's turned.
But not even her forgiveness would have been enough for him. He needed to hear from the engineer, the one person who knew the extent of his shame.
Yeah.
The one who knew that he had failed as a kamikaze pilot, that he had failed on the island, and that, you know, the other failures really, you know, mattered to the protagonist, but they didn't matter to the engineer. But hearing that the engineer forgave him for that, it had to be that. It had to be him.
Yeah. That's perfect structure right there. Yeah. That's, yeah. But then all the things of life come back to him. She's still alive, mm-hmm. and he gets to live in happiness that he didn't think he deserved.
Or does he? Because you get two things in there. One is the fact you see that little blemish on her neck, and I think that's supposed to be like it's like she's marked by Godzilla somehow, like radiation or something.
I didn't notice that.
Yeah, but then of course there's the other one, which is after they succeed in blowing up Godzilla, you see that chunk that's starting to regenerate.
Yeah.
Setting up, of course, the sequel, should there be one.
I'm not sure what the sequel would be.
Well, they could have done a sequel to Shin Godzilla. It was mm-hmm. a really interesting shout-out that they do at the end, or not shout-out, but an implication they do at the end of it, which if you haven't seen Shin Godzilla, after you run out and see Godzilla Minus One while you still can.
And you should.
And you should. Go see Shin Godzilla, which is available on DVD.
I haven't seen that.
It's definitely worth seeing, because what they do is they have Godzilla constantly mutating throughout.
Yeah, I saw that.
Yeah, and it they hint at what the final mutation would have been, and it's just it goes in a place no other Godzilla film has ever gone, and it never and they never pick that up the sequel. So, but hey, I'll accept. I'm fine that they didn't if they gave us this movie.
Yeah, it was great. I think you could have replaced Godzilla with anything else, like maybe the U.S. has some big new weapon mm-hmm. that they're, like it could be the atomic bomb. You can replace it with that, and it would still be an amazing story about this character. The threat is part of the story, but even without the threat, like, I don't know. It's just a good personal story.
It is
what I'm saying.
And it really is the kind of thing that I think all too often gets downplayed or ignored when doing monster movies.
Forgotten. Yeah.
I mean, it's kind of like Godzilla came.
Go ahead. What I'm thinking is like all those. When I think of Godzilla movies, it's like the boardroom's full of people, and it's like that's what I was picturing going into this movie because I hadn't seen any of the trailers. And I'm like, I really don't want to have to keep track of a whole bunch of different people.
Yeah, it's the kind of thing I felt that the Gareth Edwards Godzilla was going for. And unfortunately, they didn't pull it off as well as they could have.
Yeah.
No offense to Aaron Taylor Johnson, because I think he might agree with this, is that he's just not the actor that Bryan Cranston is.
Yeah, that's true.
Cranston could have pulled that off in his sleep.
That's probably the biggest thing, the killing off Bryan Cranston. It could have been much better if he'd gone through the whole thing.
But we could say that for a future, you know.
Yeah.
So
cool. So that is our review of Godzilla Minus One.
Five out of five stars.
Yep. 5 stars for you.
Yeah.
Where would I rate it? I think I'll go 4 stars too. I was playing with 4 or 4.5, but it's dang near perfect for me.
Yeah. So, like we said, run out and see it when you can't. If you still can.
If you like what you've heard on this episode today, please support us on Patreon. Our address is patreon.com/transcendentertainment. That's TRANSCEND Entertainment. Okay, on our next episode, we will have a crisscross episode, which means we compare two different films from two different eras. This episode, it's going to be Hitchcock's The Lady Vanishes from 1938 and Flight Plan from 2005 with Jodie Foster. Okay, check back in January and we'll have that review. Thank you for listening to the Crisscross Cinema Podcast.
But you wouldn't clap yet, because making something disappear isn't enough. You have to bring it back.